history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, and you might never know the incredible things they went through if you don't take the time to ask and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm confident you're going to find today's conversation with 91-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Bob Dodds pretty interesting. I caught up with Bob in Las Vegas, where he recently returned from a trip to the National World War II Memorial with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. We're going to hear about that eventually, but we'll start way earlier on his timeline. Born in Aurora, Colorado, he moved to Southern California as a young man. He jokes that maybe it was the fact that the doctor who delivered him was named Dr. Shipman, but he always had his eye on the Navy, and he even tried to sign up before he was eligible.
When I went up there, I was only 16 years old. And he said, no, you got to be 17. So I'm, well, okay, let's see. So I'm working for Taylor Electric as an electrician's helper, and one of the electricians is a ex-Navy guy. So I told him I'm thinking about going to the Navy. His good plan. Well, he liked that because that means that he could move into my position, and he had a family and everything. So anyway, he says, that's a good plan. You need me to go with you or anything? I said, no, I got this all lined out. I'm pretty good at this. So I went home and told my dad that I'd been down to see the Navy recruiter, and he says, you can't go in anyway. You're only 16. I said, yeah, but not too far away. I'm 17, Dad. And he says, no way. So you're going to college. And I said, no way. I'm not ready for college. So he said, well, whatever you want to do, I'm not signing a paper. And I know your mom and I got to sign the paper. And I said, well, okay. So I waited till 17 and I went, took the paper down, said, you got to sign this. So he says, I'm not signing it. I said, well, I'll give you till tomorrow morning. This is me talking to my dad. I'll give you till tomorrow morning or I'm leaving for New York and I'm going to join a merchant marine. He says, they ain't going to take you. And I said, they take you at 15 or 16 years old. They don't care. I guess I snowed him a little bit because he believed me, I guess. So that night, he still hadn't signed it. So I got up the next morning. I started packing my bag. Come in and said, what do you think you're doing? I said, I'm leaving. He says, why? And I said, because I'm not going to stay here. I'm not going to live off you anymore. I'm going to go do my own thing. So he says, okay, I'll sign a paper. I said, okay, let's go up to the recruiting office. So I called the chief up, and I said, we're coming up. So the chief got Dad to sign it, and 2 days later, I'm going down to the L.A. and did all the tests and everything. They weren't going to take me. They said I had flat feet. And so one of the corpsmen says, why don't you just scrunch your toes up a little bit so you show a little bit of an arch, because they walk you through a shower. So I did that. And so he took this thing back to this doctor, and he says, you know, he's got an arch there, doctor. He says, and by the way, this is Navy. It's not Army. He's not going to be marching. So the doctor says, oh, give me a habit. And he signed it. So I got in. 2 days later, I'm on the courthouse steps, and the guy that's going to swear us into the Navy was Gene Tooney. I don't know if you're familiar with Gene Tooney, but he was a boxer.
Mm-hmm.
He boxed Sharkey and several other people, but Gene Tooney, big guy. We got on the bus and went to San Diego. 3 weeks basic training, and then you get my mom and my brother come down. My dad wouldn't come down. So we went and had breakfast or lunch or something that my mom had left. And so I finished up basic training. They asked me what I want to do. I said, I just want to go to sea. I'm tired of this. I want to go to sea. So there was about eight of us, and he took us down by bus to the docks, and we got on the USS Peleus. And from there, I said, where's this ship going? They're going to eventually Pearl Harbor. And I said, oh, boy, I get to see Hawaii. This is great. It's working out fine. Just what I wanted to do. So we got to Hawaii, and everything was fine. I just had a blast over there. We got to go to Liberty, and we rented a car. But they didn't care how old you were. You could drink. And, I mean, this is living a life, you know, until December 7th.
Right, which gave you about 2 weeks of paradise, huh?
Yeah.
Before that happened. Had you graduated high school already?
Yep. Graduated 16.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I wasn't quite five when I started school.
Uh-huh.
I was 4 years old.
What high school was that?
Hollywood High School.
Hollywood High School.
We were the Sheiks.
The you Hollywood
didn't think I'd
Sheiks.
Remember that. I played football up here, too, by the way.
Yeah.
The Furman boys, I don't know, their family had a fur store. They sold furs.
Yeah.
There was Sammy, A.B., and there was three of them. I always liked Sammy because I was a running back, and I loved running behind him because nobody messed with him. He was always on the pile pulling me out and getting me out of there before somebody hurt me bad. But they had the fur store on Sunset and Western, right by 20th Century Fox Studio there.
Well, and I'm sure some people are curious. I know we're bouncing around a little bit here, but, you know, Hollywood has such a mystique now. It's a little different now than I imagine it was when you were going to high school there. Mm-hmm. Did you see movie stars around
yeah.
town?
Oh, yeah. Guy Kibbe's daughter was in high school with me. Joe Holt, who turned out to be a state senator, was there. Billy Parnassus, his dad was a fight promoter. Art Aragon was one of his fighters. There were a lot of famous people then going to school there. And, you know, at certain times, the kids would leave school because they'd be on the lot and they wouldn't be at school. So they would do school on the set and bring that work back to the class and show them. So they kept up pretty well with what was going on.
What made you so determined to get into the Navy? Did you know a war was coming? Did you think something might be happening?
Well, no. I never thought that. I'm thinking Dr. Shipman. And that in the fifth grade, my school teacher, Mrs. Poundstone, had a boyfriend. And he was a chief quartermaster. And he used to come pick her up. And one day she had him at class talking about the Navy and everything. And he says, why don't you get this class and bring them down? He was on the USS Pennsylvania. Why don't you bring the kids down, bring them aboard on a field trip, and we'll show them around the ship. So she says, I'll see if I can get permission to do that, which she did. So the whole class went down there. Them sailors treat us like kings. They took us down in the mess deck, and they gave us all pop and candy and all this stuff. And I thought, boy, this is the life. And they were working out, doing bench pressing stuff and doing that stuff because it's on a weekend. And so I thought, boy, this is a good life. This ain't bad. I mean, you get plenty of food. You can do workout, which I was working out a lot. And I get to go see things. So that's for me. That pretty much lined it up. And then the guy that was the Navy guy, the electrician, it just seemed like everything was Navy. And it appealed to me. Mm-hmm. The Army didn't appeal to me.
So you join the Navy at 17. Mm-hmm. You head to Pearl Harbor. You've only been there 2 weeks. You're still 17 years old when December 7th rolls around. What were you doing the night before? What happened on December 6th?
I didn't get to go ashore. I had the duty. I was standing dock watch. They put you out on the dock with a rifle, and you walk up and down, chase rats going up the lines and stuff like that. It was just something to keep you busy, I guess.
And this is a sub-tender, the ship you're on, the Peleus.
Yeah, we had two submarines alongside, the Tautog and we had all the T&G boats. That was our squadron. But everybody else, there was Tony Ballesteri and Laddie Olis and Coburn and all the bosun mates, they were in town. They got drunk as hell, and they come back, and I don't know what time. Anyway, I seen them go up the gangway, and they were being poured against the gangway, I think, because they were really had it.
Because you're up there on watch, so you see all these guys coming back from a night on the town.
Oh, yeah. So I thought, well, I'm probably glad I didn't get in there because I'd have been in trouble anyway, you know, with the way I felt. So I didn't like being on watch that much, and it's boring. But the next morning, my job and the other kid, Lampley, our job was to go up in the gear locker and make coffee so that when these clowns got up, these bosun mates got up, they could go to the gear locker and have coffee. That was our job. I became a seaman second class at that time. So I got up early and went up on deck and made the coffee. And when I come out of the gear locker, I seen these planes coming over from the over top of the sub base barracks and over top of us. And what the hell's going on here? Boy, they're flying pretty low. And all of a sudden, I hear a big explosion. I look across Ford Island where the battleships were, and there's a big puff of smoke, and I'm thinking, well, maybe they're just playing around or something. And then a couple more come over, and I thought, no, they're not playing around. This is serious. And they came from the east, right over the sub-base barracks, and we were close enough, the dock is close enough to say sub-base barracks, that it's a three-story building, that they couldn't see us. They weren't aiming for us anyway. I mean, they were aiming for the battleships and the dry docks, which were over there. So I went down below, and I told Tony, I said, you know, Tony, you better get up. Get out of here, kid. Get out of here. And I said, okay, go to Ladiolas, the Frenchman. And I said, you better get up there because there's stuff going on up there, a lot of noise and some smoke and everything. So he said, get out of there too. So Lampley gets up, and he said, what's going on? And I said, I don't know. So anyway, I finally went and I shook the bunk, and I figured, well, Tony, you got to get up. And I shook his bunk, and he jumped up out of there, and I run up the ladder so he couldn't catch me. And he chased me up there, and when he got up the top of the ladder, he says, holy shit. And here comes Latiolus up there, and they're all drunk in their skivvies and everything. And, wow, so they went and somebody had sounded general quarters. They got an alarm that they sound. That was back on the quarter deck someplace. So they sent me back there, tell the officer deck. So I go back there, and the officer deck got a 45, and he shoot a 45 at these planes. And they finally got all the ammunition lockers open, and we got 2 3-inch guns and forward and I think 2 aft. I can't remember. They got a 5-inch aft. I remember they were just 3-inch guns. They never fired them.
Mm-hmm.
While I was on there, and we never fired them.
Had never had a reason to.
No, not even for target practice. I mean, you'd think after that, every place you went, you had target practice. If you just shoot the guns at nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that we got the ammunition out, got the guns going, there were still a few planes, and we shot a little bit and fired some 50 calibers that were up on the King Post, 50 caliber machine guns. And they made one strafing run at us, and all they hit was there were some hit the submarines alongside, but a couple of them hit the captain's gig and the deck of the boat. Other than that, we had no damage at all. The Tautog was not able to get underway because they were doing an engine overhaul on her, and they had the periscope out and everything, so she couldn't leave. Of course, the sub-base barracks, I mean, that was the sub-base, and you had to have a special tag to get in sub-base. You could get in the base with an ID card, but you couldn't get on the sub-base unless you had a special ID card. It's called a silent service or something like that.
Right, right.
So we didn't have many people over there except the people we knew. We had the torpedo repairs, the periscope repairs, radio repairs, and all kinds of machine shops that could completely overhaul an engine. They could pull the engine out of the sub, and we could do everything to a submarine. The thing of it was, we were supposed to leave in January and go to the Philippines, Cavite, and relieve the USS Holland. And the Holland was coming back to the States for refit. And we were going to be at Cavite right next to Corregidor. And fortunately or unfortunately, we didn't make that. But the Holland got out okay, so she got out of there okay. She wound up down in Australia. But we went back to San Francisco from there and loaded up a bunch of supplies and everything and then headed for Australia, and we were going to relieve her down there. We were all by herself, no convoy, we thought. However, come to find out later, there was 4 submarines escorting us.
Hmm.
So we made it fine. I mean, we got around to, we pulled into Sydney, stayed there overnight, went around and actually went into Albany and the Tasmanian Sea there, and Australian Bight. And we pulled in there and set up a base there for submarines. Come to find out, that was a little bit too far from the action because the submarine would use too much fuel to get down there for repair. So they moved us around to Fremantle, which is on the west coast, and that was a little shorter run for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much where we stayed for a while. But then they thought, well, we'll move them up to a place called Sharks Bay, which is a little farther north on the west coast, and we set up there for a repair. However, it was an open harbor with nothing there. It was just no town around or anything. So we set up nets around and the submarines would pull inside these nets in case any torpedoes. It would stop torpedoes. And then they set whaleboat out there with depth charges rigged up on the side, and we patrolled the mouth of the harbor with this sonar and depth charges. In case if we heard anything, we were supposed to drop depth charges off this whaleboat. And thinking back, if we'd have dropped a depth charge off that whaleboat, it probably would have shot the whaleboat down too.
I was going to say.
But that was, everything was played by ear. I mean, nobody had a thought. So then they figured, well, we'll move you up a little closer. They took us up to the north end of Australia, and we stayed up there. But the storms in that area, you couldn't anchor or moor a ship there because the winds, they call them willy-waws. No matter how many anchors you put out, it would drag anchor.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed there overnight, and the captain said no. So we went back to Fremantle. That's when I got off, is Fremantle.
Right. And I want to talk about that, but I want to take you back. I mean, you talk about playing it by ear. I mean, December 7th seems like the ultimate play it by ear. Here, you don't expect an attack. Your guys on your ship don't even believe you that it's happening.
Nope.
But here you are with all these Japanese airplanes coming over. What went through your mind as a 17-year-old in a situation like that? I mean, were you scared? Were you panicking? Were you trying to figure out something to do?
I was figuring out something to do, and then I thought I made a big mistake joining the Navy. This is a big mistake. In other words, I also was looking, well, what can I do? I can't get these guys up. What am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know because I hadn't been in long enough to figure out what all this Navy had. Navy hadn't really figured out a lot of stuff. When you go through basic training, all they're really teaching is Navy rigs and how to conduct yourself and stuff like that. They give you firefighting and you get to go to the range and shoot a clip of bullets, and mostly it's just learning the Navy regs and background Navy history and stuff like that. That's all they do in boot camp. But as you said, when I come up out of that thing, I said, boy, did I make a big mistake here. Big boo-boo. But it worked out okay.
Well, and you described the limited defenses that your ship had.
Yeah.
But I read that the Peleus was credited with shooting down one airplane and damaging another.
They said that, but...
You're a little skeptical?
I'm a little skeptical. We put a lot of bullets up. There's no doubt about that. We shot a lot of ammo, but there were other ships shooting too. So how do you define...
Sure.
I mean, there was a nest of destroyers over on the other side of that where the island goes around, and they were firing at the same time. In fact, a couple of them got sunk over there. And they were coming this way, and we were shooting that way. So how do you define who hit a ship? I mean, we didn't really aim at anything. We had pointers and trainers on there, but they'd fire. I mean, who knows where it went.
And did it seem like this lasted for a long, long time, or was it over in a flash?
To me, it lasted a long time. It really wasn't that long, but to me, it seemed like a long time. And then after that, we had gun watches. We were on the guns 24 hours a day on them 3-inch guns because they weren't sure what was – nobody knew what was happening.
Yeah, who knows if there's an invasion coming.
They've actually figured that.
Right.
And they figured there would be an invasion. In fact, they issued us helmets and rifles and ammunition belts. They didn't give us any ammunition, but they gave us a belt. So I figured, what the hell am I going to do with a rifle with no bullets, you know? But I guess they'd have been available if it needed, so.
When did you grasp the magnitude of the damage there?
Okay. I would say hoping we didn't go there, but the next day, next 3-4 days, we put the motor launches and whaleboats in the water along with other ships, and the harbor was completely coated with black oil. The whole harbor was full of oil. And those days, the only thing we had was sand. We had sand dumped in the boat and straw, bales of straw. And what we were doing was taking the sand and scattering it, trying to get the oil to sink, and the straw would pick up some and with pitchforks like and put it back in the boat. Doing this, every once in a while when you take something and pick up that straw, you'd pick up an arm or a leg or one time a head. We picked up a head.
Mm.
And so we didn't know. We put them in the boat and asked somebody, what do we do with these? And they said, well, take them down to the receiving station, which is east of where the battleships were. Just drop them off there. And we had no place to unload the straw, so we didn't know what to do with the straw. It was all full of oil and everything. So we'd ask somebody, where do you put the straw? So finally they said, well, take it over by the Coast Guard base. It's on the channel going out, and drop it off there, which we did. And that went on for 3 days. And that was the worst part of the whole deal. I look back on it now, and I don't know how come we did that. How could we do that? But we did it. Not knowing what the heck, if there were going to be an invasion. Here we are out there with pitchforks and a boat picking up straw. What if they start landing troops or something? So, you know, all kinds of things run through your mind. And then getting back to the ship, you got oil all over your clothes, and you have to buy your own clothes.
Right.
However, shirts were 25 cents and pants were 50 cents. So, but here's the but. When you first get out of there, when I first went aboard the Peleus, my pay was $21 a month.
Mm-hmm.
I get $10 one payday and $11 the next. Now, when you make seaman second class, you really are in tall cotton because you're getting $38 a month.
Ooh-hoo.
And boy, you're fat city then. I mean, you could buy drinks for the house. So it made a little better when you made seaman second class, but you still had to buy your own clothes and your shoes. So those days were pretty tough when it comes to dollars. I mean,
sure.
We didn't have money. So.
And, you know, I don't want to take you anywhere you don't want to go. And I realize this is not easy to talk about, even though it's been almost 75 years now. But you're a 17-year-old.
Yep.
And you're picking up parts of your fellow sailors who just got killed. Is there anything that prepares you for that? How do you cope with a situation like that?
You don't. I mean, there's. I don't think there's any classes you can take to prepare you for that. I don't know. Maybe if you're, even if you're going to medical school, you don't look at that. And it's just, and then the guys that were left aboard ship, nobody's even trying to get them out.
Mm. And yeah, there's guys trapped in the Oklahoma at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're hearing pings on the wall, bulkheads. And it all comes down to the fact that a lot of the sailors, the guys that are older, blamed Admiral Kimmel for a lot of this. What was happening this particular weekend, all the voids were open on all the ships, and they were going to be a big inspection of the fleet that was in Pearl Harbor, the readiness of the fleet.
Right.
And checking all the voids and all of ammunition law of storerooms, and everything was open. Now, if everything had been closed, let's say the voids were closed, the ship was sealed off, ready for battle, those battleships would not have sunk.
Hmm.
They would not have sunk. There's actually two hulls on a battleship.
Right.
And I was on the Iowa, so I know a lot about
battleships.
But everything was open for an inspection, a fleet inspection. And all this is going on when they know in Washington that something, they're arguing with the Japanese about something and pushing them in a corner. The Japanese had nowhere to go except to what they were going to do.
Right. It's only a matter of timing.
Exactly.
Well, and speaking of timing, we're up against our first commercial break. When we come back, we're going to hear about the difficult duty Bob had in the days that followed the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and how, after being transferred to a destroyer, he had to survive overnight floating in the water when his ship was sunk off Guadalcanal. Check out the photos and videos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Bob Dodds of Las Vegas, Nevada. He was a baby-faced 17-year-old on the sub-tender USS Peleus at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
You know, I think of what we know now and what probably, you know, a lot of people who weren't born yet have heard, you know, that this awakened a sleeping giant. And we've heard, you know, remember Pearl Harbor and that refrain throughout the nation. But for you there, in the days after this attack, having the morbid duty that you had to carry out, how did it make you feel about the Japanese or about what was going to happen next?
Well, it was doubly hard for me. The reason it was doubly hard for me because I went to school with a lot of Japanese kids in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
There was Satsuma, Ken Soda, a bunch of guys that I went through grade school with, junior high school, and into high school. They were all friends of mine. Of course, they went to Japanese school. After they finished school, they went to Japanese school. And their parents had the markets, the fruit and vegetables at Safeway store. They raised a lot of stuff along the coast. And it was hard for me to figure out any of them kids that I knew doing something like this to people like me. So it was I couldn't really figure out why they would want to attack us. I mean, because I didn't know a lot of what was going on in Washington until after this is over. I always honor those people because they were hardworking. They did jobs that nobody else wanted to do, and they were good at it. They were very good in school. I really liked the Japanese people. I liked those kids I went to school with. I knew their parents, too. So it was hard for me, doubly hard.
Well, and I'm sure, you know, as you're out there fighting this war, a lot of them got locked up back in California with their families and then volunteered to fight for the country that was locking them up.
They never had a chance to do that until later.
Right.
There was no question. They gathered them up without any questions at all. And that bothered me because they took their house. They took their savings. They took their life away from them. I'm sure that if Ken Soda or Satsuma, some of the kids I went to school with, were offered at that time to go maybe fight in Europe, they probably would have jumped at the chance. But that didn't happen until later on.
Yeah, they were denied. They were told they couldn't. They were enemy aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've talked to a lot of guys who were there on December 7th. Most of them lost somebody that day that they knew. In your position on your ship with where you were, it sounds like you were in a pretty fortunate position that you were shielded by that sub-barracks.
Exactly.
Did you have anyone that you knew that you were friends with that was one of those casualties that day?
Nope.
That's a pretty big blessing, isn't it?
Yeah. I was in the right place at the right time.
And have you been back there?
Well, when I was in the Navy, we stopped in there on the way back. Mm-hmm. I have no love for that place.
So since they've built the Arizona Memorial, you haven't been to that?
No.
And no desire to?
No.
Brings back too many bad memories?
I still think about those guys that could have had a chance if things had been different. People mm-hmm. would have paid attention. They could have been saved. And I don't want to go back there now. No.
So you told us how you moved on from there. You stay on the Peleus all the way to Australia. Mm-hmm. And why'd you leave the ship? Pretty good to you. What's the deal?
Well, I got transferred to new construction. That was the idea. And I got on the Gold Star, and they shipped us around the southern part of the island, and they pulled into Brisbane. Supposedly, we were going to go back to the States for new construction. However, what they were doing was bringing ships over with short crews and taking the guys who had lost ships and putting them on there. And instead of sending us all the way back to the ship, they just put us on the ship.
All right.
So what happened in Brisbane, there was a ship there. I think it was a mail boat or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it wasn't a war-type ship anyway. And they put us on there. There was four of us. There was Robbie the Gunner, Dick Marotta, Bobby King, and me, four of us. So they assigned us to the Monson. So I said, well, where the hell is the Monson? Well, we're going to take you there. So I can't remember if we went to Noumea or New Caledonia. I'm pretty sure it was Noumea. When we got there, we loaded our sea bags, got aboard ship, and they were getting underway. So we gave our records to the officer of the deck as we climbed the ladder, handed him our records. And they said, well, go below and stow your gear and stay in the berthing compartment. Well, they were at GQ. The task force was leaving Noumea, and they were heading out. I looked at Bobby King, who was a third-class gunner, and I said, boy, that's a hell of a welcoming. We don't even get to go to the personnel office. We don't get anything. We haven't even eaten yet. So Dick Marotta and Bobby King, there were a couple of reserves. Well, I knew I shouldn't have joined the Navy, blah, 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 blah. And I said, shut up, because Robbie and I were regular Navy. Those were reserves.
Uh-huh.
So we stayed down there till we got to port. So we went up on the bridge, and the officer of deck says, well, we don't have any billets for you, so what are you? And I said, well, I'm a bosun mate. Okay, you're not part of a gun crew, so we're going to put you as bosun mate of the watch. And you, the bosun mate of the watch, you get on in the number one mound up there in a 5-inch gun. So I'm on the bridge. So Dick Marotta and Bobby King were both engine men, so they needed somebody on the emergency generator, so they put them there. And Robbie was a third-class gunner's mate, so he knew about guns and everything, so they put him on the aft 5-inch gun. So we get up to Guadalcanal, at least that's where we were heading, this task force, and we were doing some firing on the way. Ships or planes were flying. I was firing on the way up on the bridge, and I don't even know anybody. I don't know a soul on that bridge. So anyway, make a long story short, they sent, I think it was two cruisers and a carrier, and I think it was six destroyers, I think, and I think the Aaron Ward was one of them, the Bushnell and Monson. So they know the Japanese fleet is coming down, and that's why we're sent out to stop the reinforcement of Guadalcanal and Tulagi, because they were going to split the force. They were going to drop troops at Guadalcanal mm-hmm. and also reinforce the troops at Tulagi. Now, the Marines were at Tulagi, and the Army and Marines were at Guadalcanal. So the first thing that happened, there's a Sable Island. It's a passage on each side of Sable Island. So what the task force commander did was split the group and send some this way and send some this way to catch either way they went.
Sure.
Well, we got the bulk of them. So the first thing happened.
You got the wrong side of the coin.
We got the wrong side of the coin that time.
And this is November of 1942.
Yes. It's about, I don't know, around 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night.
All right.
And all of a sudden, searchlights come on. It's the Japanese shining searchlights on us. And I'm thinking, oh, boy. This ain't us, and we're not good. I'm on the bridge. Well, the first thing hit turret, the gun mount, number 5-inch gun mount, and blew it up. It was gone. Something, a torpedo hit midships or somewhere along midships on the port side, and the next one hit the bridge. Well, at the time it hit the bridge, I was back in the chart room trying to look and see what the heck was going on with the chart because I didn't know what was going on. Well, it killed everybody on the bridge, so I was how did I miss that?
How long ago had you been there? Just minutes?
Yeah.
Minutes before, you're on the bridge. If you're still there, you're gone.
Yeah.
But for some reason, you're back in that chart room.
I went back in the chart room. And it did blast the door open, the watertight door. It did break the seal on it. But I went back out. There was one guy still moving. And he says, we got to abandon ship. So I thought, whoa. So I tried passing a word over the speaker system, abandoned ship. It didn't work. It was out. It's gone.
You get on the microphone and it's dead.
It's dead. So I thought, well, hell with this. I'm getting out of here. So I went down and I went back aft. I found Robbie. He was climbing out of the rear mount back there because he knew the ship had been hit and was listing. And I got to Bobby King and Dick out of there. And I said, let's get the hell off here because they're going to abandon ship. So we were back aft on the starboard side. So I said, the freeboard is really not too low. It's short, maybe 4 or 5 feet, something like that.
All right.
So I said, let's go over here because we get off because the ship was listed to that side.
It's listing and it's burning, right? I mean, there's fire everywhere.
Oh, yeah. So we go over the side back aft. So we're in the water and other ships, are lights are going on there. Everybody's shooting. A couple of ships run into each other. It was a mess. So anyway, we're all four in the water. And I said, look, got to swim. Got to get away from this because that ship goes down. It's going to pull us in. So we swam and got away from it. We've had a little bit of a pull, but not enough to bother us. So we're in the water. So Dick says, we got to swim. I said, where? It's dark. Where? He says, well, there's got to be land someplace. I said, well, there is. Maybe it's 30 miles away. Maybe it's 100 miles away. Maybe it's only 2 miles away. I'm staying right here. And he says, what about sharks? I said, I'm not worried about sharks. I'm worried about getting run over by another ship, chew us up in the props. So what we got to do is stay together, stay here. So they said, well, we'll swim. I said, go for it. Robbie and I stayed together. So they took off a little bit. Pretty soon they come back and says, maybe you're right. So the next morning, the daylight's coming, and here comes a ship. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I hope this is one of ours. Well, it was a mine layer or mine sweeper. So they pick us up. I heard them say they got us all aboard. Well, this is all there is. There's just four of them. So I naturally assumed that everybody's dead. Four of us are alive. And I said, what are you guys doing? Well, we're laying mines here because they're expecting the Japanese to land troops on this because it's Japanese held. So we're laying mines to stop them from landing on the beach here. And I looked at Dick and I said, now, dummy, how do you feel now? If we'd have swam to the beach, that was Japanese territory. How do you feel now, you stupid jerk? I was really mad at him. Both of them. I said, you damn reserves. You don't even got any brains at all. You ought to be back selling shoes. I was just really upset. And he kept bringing that up all the time, every time we had got together. Says, you still think I ought to be selling shoes? But anyway, they picked us up and embedded us with the Marines on Tulagi because they were fighting in Tulagi. However, later on, I find out there was about 100 and some guys that actually survived, but picked up on the port side by other ships and taken to Guadalcanal and embedded with the Army over there. So they put us with the Marines and had us loading ammo and stuff like that. That's what we were doing for the Marines. And we actually are attached to the Beachmaster there.
So how long were you in the water?
Overnight, from about probably midnight till 7:30, maybe 8 o'clock. I don't know what time exactly, but it was late morning for us because Reveille's usually at 6, so it was definitely after 6 o'clock. So.
That's a lot of time to be in the water. Did you have something to hold on to stay
afloat?
Oh,
we had life jackets.
You had your Mae West?
Yeah. They were oil-soaked, full of oil and everything, but they worked. And the shark repellent packets, they had gone. We didn't have any shark repellent packages. Usually you have a little bag, attached to them and a little flashlight. We didn't have that, which I'm glad because them jerks would have probably had a flashlight or something like that. So.
Did you see any sharks?
Well, later on, yeah. I'd seen barracuda and sharks, yeah. After when we were in Tulagi, they had built a dock, so boats could get into the dock there. The Beachmaster had a dock built. And you go down there at night and shine a light in the water, and you'd see all these barracuda and sharks, little baby sharks swinging around there, yeah.
So they may have been around you this whole time, but you couldn't see them while you're in the water.
But then
seeing that later, you said, boy, I'm glad I didn't see them.
Yeah, that's right. That was an experience.
Was there any point in those 7 hours where you thought, I don't know if anyone's going to find us? I don't know if we're ever going to get out of this?
Oh, I knew I was going to get out of it.
How'd you know?
I just knew. Some way I'm going to get out of this. I'm not going to die here. I'm going to get out of this. Some way I'm going to make it. Now, maybe you guys ain't going to make it, but I'm going to make it.
And when you say you knew you were going to get out of it, is that because you were confident in yourself? Did you think there was somebody else looking out for you? Where was that assuredness coming from?
You're going to think I'm nuts. Everybody thinks I'm nuts. But all through my life, I've always felt that somebody's looking over you. I'm not a real religious guy, but I always felt that I got some kind of an angel that's looking out for me. And that angel is never going to let me down. I know that sounds goofy, and I don't tell that to everybody. I've always felt there's an angel. He gave me an angel. Look out for this guy. He needs a lot of help. That's what I felt. And I knew that I was going to make it out of there. There was no doubt in my mind.
I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm thinking about this. You're 18 years old. Mm-hmm. You've been in the Navy for a little over a year, mm-hmm. and you've already been through the worst surprise attack that the American military's ever experienced, and then your ship sinking and surviving 7 hours in the water near hostile-held territory. I guess you have to believe you've got somebody looking out for you if you're going to continue in that. That's a lot to go through as an 18-year-old.
Well, it's been through that way throughout my whole naval career, and even now. I still feel that angel is looking. How else would I be this old? Somebody's looking out for me. As I said, I'm not a religious guy. I do think there's probably a higher power, but I haven't got all the way with that yet.
And it doesn't sound like a superstition.
No, I'm not superstitious about nothing.
It's just something that you've been through enough to see it time and time again.
Yep.
Well, and if you haven't figured it out yet, maybe that's why you're still going, because there's still something to figure out.
It'll eventually come around, I think. that angel will probably say, well, you're kind of on your own now because I got somebody else I got to worry about. So I think that'll probably happen somewhere along the line, but I'm ready for that.
You mentioned being with the Marines at Tulagi. So here, your ship's gone. It mm-hmm. went down in flames. They've since found it. They found the wreckage down there at the bottom of
they
that
did.
Sound. Yeah, you can still
my
see
dog
the
tag is still down there in my locker, too.
So if you're listening today and you're up for an adventure, maybe you can go dive in Iron Bottom Sound off of Guadalcanal and find Bob's lost dog tag. You'll find a video of Bob explaining the dog tags he does have on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're nowhere near finished with this 26-year veteran of the U.S. Navy. Before we're done, he'll share the highlights of his honor flight to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending some time with Bob Dodds of Las Vegas, Nevada. He spent 26 years in the Navy, retiring as a chief petty officer in 1967. 4 of those years were on the USS Iowa during the 1950s. That's a ship you can visit today in San Pedro, California, and you'll learn that it fired more rounds than any other battleship in the Korean War. But let's go back to November of 1942 off of Guadalcanal. Bob told us he was rescued after floating in oil-soaked waters for 7 hours. His destroyer, the USS Monson, had been sunk, and he and 4 buddies were pressed into action with the Marines on Tulagi. So how'd those leathernecks treat you?
Fantastic.
Yeah?
Fantastic. We had oil all over us, and of course they had Navy medics there too. They were embedded with the Marines. Our clothes were full of oil and everything, the life jackets and everything. So we stripped down, and they gave us Marine clothes to put on, so we didn't have all this oil stuff on us. And they said, well, you're a Marine now. And I said, no, I'm not. You might dress me like one, but I'm not a Marine. And so they said, well, we need help. So we were loading ammunition on little trucks and stuff like that. They were taking it up there. Tulagi's not a very big place, but they were loaded with Japanese. And even over into Purvis Bay, after they got the island secured, they pulled in an oil barge, a YO, and made of concrete. And it had bunker oil in it, which the destroyers burned and stuff like that. Had diesel. Some of them had diesel. Some of them had black oil. When they got there, they were just a short crew on there. Remember, there was four of us are still together. There was no place for us to stay when Tulagi, so they put us on this YO there in Tulagi Harbor. Well, after they got everything cleaned up and everything, it was pretty much secure. They moved that oil barge over to Purvis Bay. The thing had no freeboard. It was full of oil. So what they did, the Seabees had built a tank farm in Purvis Bay. So they offloaded that oil into that tank farm and finally got a little freeboard. And then civilian tankers, merchant marine tankers come alongside refill, and then destroyers would come in. By that time, the guys that were on that YO were pretty Asiatic. One instance, there was a chief boat's mate who was a captain, Lewis M. Seiler. They called him Shanghai, a drunk from the word go. But he'd been a China sailor, been in China for years. I think he had, at that time, he had about 22, 23 years in. He was from the old-time sailor. And then Robbie was the gunner's mate. He was in charge of the armory. We had machine guns and rifles and pistols and stuff like that. We had Red Ingram, who knew about pumping oil. I don't remember all the guys' names, but they were pretty much a wild lot. I mean, fighting all the time, and I had my chance at several of them. But Robbie and Seiler, they were at odds all the time. Seiler wanted a .45, and Robbie says, you don't need a .45. Seiler says, I'm the captain here, and I want a .45. And Robbie says, you don't need a .45. So Seiler goes and breaks into the armory and gets a .45 and comes out. And he says, now give me the keys of the armory. And Robbie says, no. And Robbie goes in the armory and he gets a .45. So here they are standing out on the deck, both of them pointing a gun at each other, this way and this way. And they're going to shoot each other to see who gets the keys. And I'm standing there and I'm thinking, I'm the executive officer. I'm the second in command, being the boat's mate. So I'm wondering, what the heck am I going to do with these two guys? I like Robbie. I don't like Seiler. I hope Robbie shoots Seiler. I mean, that's the way I was thinking in those days.
Mm-hmm.
The other guys were just as Asiatic. I mean, they'd be yelling, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him. You know, I mean, it was like a mutiny. They stood there for maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, and finally I thought, this has gone far enough. So I went up there, and I grabbed this gun, and I grabbed that one, and I took them, and I threw them in the water. I threw them away. And Seiler looks at me and said, now you're destroying government property. I'm going to have you court-martialed. I said, no, you're not, because if you try to court-martial me, I'm going to slit your throat and throw you over the side. That's the way I'm going to do with you. So anyway, it all settled down after that. Just there was a bunch of crazy guys on this YO, and they'd been out there too long. We'd been out there way too long.
And when you use that term, Asiatic, maybe some folks today aren't familiar with what that means, but basically what you're saying is you guys have been in these warlike situations for so long that it's messing with your minds a little bit. Your perspective is off.
Exactly. They put a label on it now, and those guys today, even today, like in Desert Storm, they went through a lot of stuff too, fighting a war that wasn't a war. It's just crazy sending guys over there like Vietnam. We shouldn't have been in Vietnam. I was over there, and it was crazy. Why are we there? Why are we in Korea? It was a police action. What do we care about police action? It's none of our business. I mean, after seeing all this stuff and sending guys over there for to play policeman, that's nutty. If you're going to fight somebody, fight to win or don't fight at all. And that's what it was in World War II. And that was the attitude of every sailor, Marine soldier during World War II. We're going to win.
It wasn't something, I'm sure, at the time that was easy to talk about, and there are a lot of people that still won't talk about it, but your transparency and candor about the mental scars of war. I mean, you get a Purple Heart if you lose a leg, but, you know, if your brain gets rewired, they're not handing out medals for that. What would you say, for someone who hasn't experienced that, how big of an issue has this been for you for the last 75 years?
It's been a troubling one. My wife, I'd come home sometimes and she'd say something, I'd pick up a chair and throw it, or pick up a lamp and throw it. Just, I've had enough of your shut up, and, you know, just crazy. One time she got the kids and got out because I was over the edge. I completely tore up a house, completely. Broke furniture, broke windows. I never hurt them. I never went after them. But I did throw a bunch of stuff. It was hard on her. It was hard on the kids, too, because I was a disciplinarian. I never beat them or anything like that. But I would, if they didn't keep their room clean, I throw their clothes out the window. And even in work, when I got my contractor's license and stuff like that, even then, afterward, I'd still blow up and throw. I'd right here in town.
Have you ever found anything that helped you deal with that? Helped you control it?
Right now, yeah. If something bothers me, I usually go sit in my chair and just shut up. It doesn't happen much anymore. I'd still lose it once in a while, but not like that. The way I control it, just go sit down on my chair and shut my eyes and just calm down.
Mm-hmm.
When these guys are being treated for PTSD, that's pretty much what they do to them too. However, they do give them drugs.
Right.
And my drug was alcohol. I got a pretty good handle on it now, so that's not a problem for me anymore.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned your angel that's been with you. Were there some times during the Korean War where you felt like that angel showed up?
Yep. I knew my wife was going to have a baby. I was hoping that somehow I would find out when the baby was born. So we'd been firing all night. We'd been in the turret since, I think, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. They secured, we retreated, pulled off. And I went down to the birthing compartment, and the messenger from the bridge come down and says, you got a message up in the radio shack. And something told me she had the baby. So I go up the radio shack, and there it was. It was a girl, and said how much she weighed and everything. And I thought, wow, that angel took a little time off for me and went back and looked over that. So I thought, well, that's a pretty good deal. And so then I had to go buy cigars and give everybody cigars.
There's a lot of people on a battleship.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't buy them for everybody. But it was a highlight for me, getting that message from the on the firing line in Korea that my daughter had been born. I thought that was really something.
Have you ever gotten involved with the Pearl Harbor survivors or any of those groups?
No, we were out of the commissary one time. This one gentleman come up to me and says, I see you're a Pearl Harbor survivor. I said, yeah, because I have a hat.
Sure.
And he says, why don't you join us sometime? I said, well, I don't know. I'm not really a joiner. So he gave me a card or something like that, but I never did pursue it because I just wasn't ready to talk about it to everybody. This is quite a while back. It's only been the last, I don't know, few years that I felt like talking about anything about this stuff. I always felt like, who cares? That's what I always felt. Who cares? That's old passe, and they don't want to hear all that stuff.
Well, it strikes me that you had a pretty recent example, and it's pretty overwhelming evidence that people do care. And you might have been the only guy on this trip who was in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, 26 years in the Navy. But you just recently got back from Honor Flight Southern Nevada, flying from Las Vegas to Washington, D.C. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, out of this world. It was, I could never in my wildest dream imagine anything like this happening. It was just beyond belief that people would care that much. I mean, everywhere we went, there were people applauding us and wanting signed stuff and wanting pictures. Mothers were crying. I remember one mother coming up to me, her daughter had braces on, and I'd always ask them, first name, what's your name? And how old are you? I'm glad you came up to talk to me. I said, I really like talking to you. And the mother would be standing there crying. I said, what are you crying for? I'm the one that should be crying. I'm the one that really appreciates these little kids coming. She says, I just think the veterans aren't getting their due. And I said, we are today. Mm. And she says, well, I'm so happy for you. So I couldn't believe the attention we got. It just, I never would have in my wildest dreams, as I said, a picture anything like this happening, that people would care that much. It's amazing. Totally unbelievable until you experience it.
Had you been to any of those memorials before?
No, that was my first trip.
The World War II Memorial, the Korean Memorial, the Vietnam Memorial. You were in all three of those.
Mm-hmm.
Which one of those spots grabbed you the strongest?
That World War II. The thing about that, and I mentioned it to Dan, there are pilasters all the way around, and tying these together are more, it's a concrete that looks like a mooring line. They're about that big around, and it encircles the whole thing like it's all tied together. And I told Dan, I said, do you ever notice that before? He said, what's that? I said, it looks like a mooring line going through all these things and kind of tying this all together. He said, I never looked at that before. And I said, that's what shows to me that everything is tied together. It's bound and it's secure. That really got me.
What comes to mind when you say that, everything being tied together? Here you've got 16 million people in uniform, everybody back home pulling together to back them up. But when you stood there and kind of in the middle of that line is a wall of gold stars. And it represents 406,000 people who didn't come home from the war. When you looked at that, what kind of thoughts ran through your mind?
Well, they didn't have the right angel. It's the only thing I can say. And they were in, I guess, the wrong place, the wrong time. It's sad that they had to go that way. For World War II guys, those are the guys that should be getting the attention because they gave it all. They gave everything. Us guys, okay, we gave some, but we didn't give it all. I appreciate the attention we got, but those guys deserve more than we do because they lost everything. And that's sad. That's really sad.
On the honor flight, what was it like to meet some of these other guys who had their own stories from the war?
Well, the interesting thing was when we were talking, some of the guardians, the younger guys who were pushing, were interested in what we were talking about, and they listened and didn't take offense at anything we said. It was refreshing.
You mentioned the guardians. So on these honor flight trips, I know you're in great shape for almost 92, but a lot of folks your age aren't. They need someone to push a wheelchair, to help you out, to meet every need. And you met your guardian in D.C., and he just seemed like a nice guy, right?
Yeah, just a normal kind of guy.
So he's pushing you around, and he's helping you out, and then you found out something about him before you left.
Yeah, we were sitting down in the lobby of the hotel. Shannon, who was one of the medics, he says, "Do you know who's this guy, your guardian?" I said, "Yeah, his name is Dan." "Do you know what he does?" "No, I don't. I didn't want to ask him what he does. You don't ask somebody something like that." He says to Dan, "Dan, do you care if I tell Bob what you're doing?" Dan says, "Yeah, go ahead." He says, "It's a colonel in the Air Force." And I'm thinking, "Colonel?" "And he works in the Pentagon." "Wow." I said, "All them stories I told you about Da Nang and all that hotel and everything." He says, "In one ear, out the other." I said, "Okay, great."
Well, here's what I'm thinking as I listen to you tell that story. I'm thinking about something you said earlier, that you hadn't talked about this for a long time. And here you're in the Navy for 26 years, World War II, Korea. We didn't really even get into your Vietnam service. And you said you didn't talk about it because who cares?
That's it.
Who really cares?
Nobody cared, at least the people I knew.
But here's a colonel in the Air Force taking time off from the Pentagon to come meet your every need on this trip.
Yes. And even, I said, don't you want a cup of coffee? I said, "Well, yeah, let me get it." "No, sit still." So when he comes back, I said, "Let me pay you for it." He said, "Bob, it's a cup of coffee." You know, I mean, and I'm thinking, here is a colonel to a lowly little old chief, and he's getting me coffee. And then we get to the dinner. I got to have dinner, by the way, the last night. Here is Dan with his wife. Guess who else is there? The commanding general of McGill Air Force Base and his wife at the same table with me. And I'm thinking, boy, am I in tall cotton now. So he gave a little speech, the colonel did, got up and talked about the honor flight. And he said he had the privilege of pushing a Pearl Harbor survivor who didn't know how important he was to this country around for 2 days. And I thought to myself, how does that happen? When he says he had the privilege of pushing me around through the rain, by the way. Oh, there's another thing. It was raining real bad, so we had to stand at attention out there at World War II when the honor guard showed up. So we stood at attention. It's raining like a son of a gun. So I go to sit down. He says, "Wait a minute." I looked around, and that seat of that wheelchair is full of water. So he's out there pushing water out of the way and gets a handkerchief and soaks it up. He says, "Sit down now before the rain gets on." I think, what a guy. What a guy.
So it kind of sounds like your honor flight experience changed your mind as to whether anybody cares.
Yes. Yes, it did. It was, I think, a healing thing because I really feel that people really care now what we did and it's important to them.
Well, you know what helps them appreciate it and understand it?
No.
You doing what you're doing. You talking about it. You going on an honor flight. You giving them the opportunity to say thank you and let you know how much it meant. So I want to join that and say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us things that only you could. One last question about the honor flight, because I haven't been in Las Vegas when one of these comes back. I've been in a lot of other ones. The Las Vegas airport is a pretty happening place. There's always a lot going on there. There's a plane coming in every 30 seconds, it seems like. What was it like when you guys got back?
People who were waiting for flights actually came and formed a column for us to come sliding through. You can't believe how many people were there. There had to be a thousands and shaking hands. When you're going along, everybody got their hand out. And they all want to shake, and little kids are handing you stuff. And it made me feel really, really, really good.
My last question for you. What are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
I'm proud that I served in the Navy for 26 years. What was the other part?
What are you most thankful for?
That I'm home. I'm proud of the time in the Navy, and I'm proud I'm home. Those two things mean a lot to me.
Well, you mean a lot to us, and I'm glad your Honor Flight experience has helped communicate that so powerfully. Honor Flight Southern Nevada is the group that Bob went with. I have a link to that website at hometownheroesradio.com. Also, a link to the National Honor Flight site, because wherever you're listening today, there's a group near you that's committed to taking our World War II veterans to their memorial. We're out of time for now. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.